Welcome to the Physics Teaching Podcast, a podcast for teachers of physics made by physics teachers.
Physics teachers like me, Robin Griffiths, a full-time teacher of physics all the way through from year 8 to year 13.
And physics teachers like me, Thomas WP, a part-time A-level mostly teacher of physics, doing chemistry with year 7 at the moment.
Is that a subject that people do?
I believe that it is. It's particles though, so it's really physics. It's really physics. So here we are, we've gone for a walk again. We're actually sitting in a little secluded spot by a pond, and we both managed to not fall in despite the steep bank we came down to get out of the wind. And this is episode 10. It should be a ways to teach episode, but be careful what you promise. It should be under promise and over deliver, shouldn't it? It's not a ways to teach episode, but we are going to trail the subject for the ways to teach episode, which will be episode 11 now.
Yeah, we are sitting here by a pond. I'm not sure that really is a pond. Isn't that a septic outfall?
It's not a visual medium, and I have a very poor sense of smell, generally not COVID-related.
Yes, anyway, so, but it is, it's nice to be out in the fresh air, and apologies for the sounds of trees rustling and garden sheds blowing by, but it is quite a windy day, and we've tried to shelter as best we can, but... So, of course, our ways to teach, which we will be doing next week, will be magnetism. So how is it that you teach magnetism? And I'm really, really interested to hear all of your thoughts on this, dear listener, because I'm about to start magnetism with year 11 in a couple of weeks' time. And I always find it really tricky, and the whole idea of magnetic fields and how they work and all these sorts of things. So I know if it's quite daunting for me, and it is quite daunting for a lot of physics teachers I know, it's going to be particularly daunting if you are a wonderful, heroic biologist or chemist who's trying to teach it as well. So please, if you have any tips of things you do for magnetism, things that you've observed as working quite well, things that seem to get the point across, do let us know and we will share it with the wider audience next week.
Yeah, so we're particularly interested actually how you introduce it to the younger kids, because we want to help out the non-specialists. But yeah, it doesn't come in much at GCSE magnetism, really, does it? They do a bit about motors and electromagnetism, but not so much, because I often, when I get to A-level and I ask them to draw a magnetic field, they really can't remember.
So I've got magnetic fields on my GCSE spec, which might be unusual, but I definitely have it there. And also the idea that, you know, when you put a ferromagnetic material near to a magnet, it itself becomes a magnet, and then their magnetic fields interact. So it's actually quite in-depth, and that's a tricky thing to get the heads around. So if you do have any tips on that, we'd be marvellous to hear from you. Of course, Key Stage 3 is the focus, but if you've got any tips on magnetism at all, that would be great.
Yeah, do you have some way of drawing a magnetic field? I always think it looks like the BFG's head with the big ears. That's how I do it. But kids don't read books nowadays, so I'm looking to update my model. So what is on the agenda today are not ways to teach episode. Well, we've just walked out here, and there's a couple of things we want to talk about. Firstly, I wanted to do a shout out to James De Winter, who came on the podcast a few episodes ago and talked about a ranking task book that you could get at vast expense. It will be in the show notes. I can't remember the name right now, in the middle of a forest, in the middle of nowhere. I just wanted to say thank you to James. I managed to get that book from America. It was cheap to buy and expensive to ship. And I've started using the ranking tasks, and they are fabulous. It's a really great way of finding the kids' misconceptions. So, you know, you show them the task, they rank it, and they say how confident they are. And you can see the ones who give 10 stars confidence and get it completely wrong. It's very useful, perhaps more useful than the kids who give 10 stars confidence and get it right. And the challenges in the ranking tasks aren't that hard, some of them. I was telling Robin on the way out, is shooting arrows horizontally from a cliff. And what they're trying to get at is the misconception that things falling from a height horizontally take longer if they're moving faster. Obviously, they take the same time if they're falling from the same height. So that's a really good way of getting to it. Have you done anything like this, Robin?
Well, I've seen these sorts of questions, and I remember seeing James do a talk at an IOP event a couple of years back when he talked about diagnostic questioning. And it is a really, really powerful technique. It is this idea that not only are you getting a right-wrong answer, but you're also getting an insight into where the students' misconceptions are, whether their understanding is just so, or whether there's still some lurking sort of misconceptions about what they're talking about. So they are a fantastic tool. They're also very, very difficult to come by. So this book is an absolute goldmine for this, an absolute godsend. But I have seen a similar thing with the Best Evidence Science Teaching resources, which you can get from the University of York. It's available on their website. If you just do Best Evidence Science Teaching in Google, it will find it. We'll put a link in the show notes, as always. And in there, they have a whole series of questions that are designed to smoke out these misconceptions. And often they're answered not just with right or wrong, but also, I am sure of this. I'm quite sure of this. I'm not at all sure of this answer. I'm completely and utterly unsure of this answer. This is a guess, basically. Mm-hmm. So they get to rank how confident they are about each of their answers that they've given, so that you can again find out. So I think, as we were saying on the chat over here, when you've got a student who gets an answer that's complete and utter hogwash, but then turns around and says, but I'm absolutely 100% confident of this, then you know you've got a deep-seated misconception, and they have a completely... they've built up what they think is a foolproof view of this, but it's absolutely and utterly completely wrong. So that is a really useful thing, unsurprisingly, for a physics teacher to know.
Yes, I have noticed it does take a bit of time. You really do need to look at the results rather than just accepting the marks. But, you know, that the value of the stuff you get is fabulous.
After chatting to Robin by the pool, I contacted James to thank him for the ranking tasks, and he pointed out to me there's a new book that I was unaware of. So I hooked up with him and thought it's time for another Dispatches with De Winter. So we were talking, as you'll hear in the podcast on Thursday, James, by a possible cesspool. But we were talking about the ranking task, and I wanted to thank you for putting me onto those. They are fab. And you said you've got another book that may have some ranking tasks in.
Yeah, well, the ranking task book is out of print, but what's happened is the giant brains behind that have kind of upgraded, and now they've got a book available called Tippers, T-I-P-E-R-S, Sense Making Tasks for Introductory Physics. That is all of the ranking tasks and a whole bunch of other questions as well. So in addition to the ranking tasks, what they've got is 9 other types of questions. And maybe we won't talk about all of them, but if I just go through them very quickly, it's just useful to get our heads around their thinking. So they've got ranking tasks, they have bar chart tasks, changing representation tasks, comparison tasks, linked multiple choice, qualitative reasoning, student contention, troubleshooting tasks, what's wrong, and working backwards. And what essentially they've done is trawled, as part of a research project, the type of questions that can help students really be made to think. So good multi-choice questions are great, and most of these are, on the surface of it, multi-choice questions, but they all have a particular flavor. But I mean, maybe it's worth me just explaining what a ranking task is, so that at least listeners without one in front of them can kind of imagine this. Now, this, of course, is almost impossible, but I'll give it a go. Imagine a ream of A4 paper. And what I want is a shape, a three-dimensional shape that essentially has 3 different surface areas. And what you would do is you'd have a picture of that ream of A4 paper sitting on the ground in each of its faces down. So flat bit down, edge bit down, side bit down. And a ranking task question would just say, this is a ream of A4 paper or brick or whatever you want to do. Look at these A, B, C, D, and order the answers from the highest pressure to the lowest pressure. And then you just have the right answer and work it through. But the thinking behind ranking tasks and the aim of the developers is to really make the student think as much as possible about all of the answers. Even in the best multi-choice questions, what can happen, particularly for the brighter or more able student, higher achieving student, is they work out what the answer is and they don't even look at the other answers. And often the other answers, if the multi-choice question has been written really well, are designed to articulate common misconceptions in that area. And if they think pressure is something else or whatever it is, then they kind of avoid those and just go straight for the right answer. Whereas what ranking tasks do is kind of dig within the right answer and get students to think about, well, which one's right or which one's higher and which one's lower. So they have to have an opinion about every single one. They can't just go, oh, B is the right answer, move on. They have to go, oh, well, B is a higher pressure than A and A is higher pressure than C. So for me, I think it's kind of like the kind of, it's a turbocharged multi-choice question in the sense that it's targeted on a particular conceptual idea. And then within that, students have to kind of understand how things might vary within that. And some of them have numbers in, some of them are qualitative. And, you know, that varies within the range of questions. But the book you've got, and this Tippers one, which has some other questions which we might get on to talking about, has just got armful upon armful upon armful of these questions. And, you know, the Tippers one's in print. I don't know. It's £20, £25, depending on the exchange rate. The question is it worth spending £25 on a book of physics questions? The answer is absolutely, categorically, yes. It's worth £50. And I really mean that in terms of the time it can save you. You know, the majority of these questions, I guess, are aimed probably would be more appropriate for, you know, the top end of your GCSE and your A-level students. But what you've got is just an extraordinarily powerful resource that you can use year after year. And so I'd advocate getting the book. I think it's quite hard to write these questions yourself. It's not impossible, but I think seeing the idea of a ranking task and thinking about, oh, how might I change some of the questions I might give students to be a kind of ranking task thing is certainly worth the time to think about. But I would caution against these. Writing good questions is a really tricky business, you know, especially, well, with normal multi-choice questions, it's getting what I would call the right-wrong answer. And within the kind of, if you were writing your own ranking tasks, it's working out what is the variable or the conceptual understanding that you want to look differences between. You know, some topics are quite easy. So in that pressure example is quite straightforward. Things around motion graphs are quite straightforward, but other topics in physics are harder to get good to write the questions yourself. So, I mean, what's quite nice about the book, you know, it's kind of 500 pages long, is it's got, I haven't even added them up, but it goes through your absolutely standard physics topics of one-dimensional motion, Newton's laws, energy, density, fluids, rotation, statics, heat and temperature, magnetism, waves. So you've just got the whole kind of suite. There's a little section at the end on kind of modern physics. But yeah, if you want a great question that's a kind of multi-choice plus, I think ranking tasks are a really useful armory to have as a physics teacher. And there's a whole research base behind that in terms of the research projects they did that if people want to dig into, they can. That's great. But equally, here's a fantastic off-the-shelf resource that you could use in your teaching.
And now back to Robin and me in the open air by a suspicious-looking pool. It would be interesting, wouldn't it, if there was some sort of central store of these rather than finding a book that's out of press. Is this something that the IOP do, Robin? Do they have a lovely free website of beautiful things like this? Is that something they do?
Well, they have a website where they have all their resources. I'm not sure how many go along the lines of being diagnostic questions, but I know there's a lot of interest at the IOP about this subject, and I know they would like to do some more in this area. The difficulty is always, it's always a money thing and trying to get the funding to do that. So it is, you know, an important area. But as James himself will say, and when we next speak to him, I'm sure we'll ask him, these diagnostic questions are very difficult to write well, and they're difficult to do in such a way that you are getting that really rich information about the students' answers. So it isn't just as simple as, you know, bashing out a multiple choice test in forms, which is pretty much my formative assessment at the moment, it must be said, because we're so busy. But, you know, that's kind of the day-to-day average thing. This is much more involved and much more thought out, much more in-depth, and really getting to grips with what each wrong answer means in terms of the students' understanding and where they're at with the topic. So they're difficult things to do, and I know the IOP are interested, but I don't think there's anything out there at the moment that I've seen. Unless, of course, dear listener, you know different.
Yeah, we were chatting on the way over about how many transient sets of resources there are for teachers, and there's no sort of central repository. Strikes me that maybe that's something IOP could become. They have their news groups, they have their forums, they have Spark, of course. Maybe we need sections in there. I go all the way back to Ben Rogers, and he had his what did he call them, where you have a misconception, and he had a statement, and they had to finish it off. Some people think, he had a word, a name for them, I can't remember what it is, but I will put it in the show notes. Future Thomas will perhaps make an entrance here and remind us what they are. So yeah, it would be useful to have a solid long-term store of those, but I'm just not sure what that is. I mean, I've made this resources site for the podcast, but that, you know, that might last another year, it might last 10, it might last a week. It depends on how I feel, doesn't it, like any of these things. So that's a really interesting idea. Is there a central repository? Is the IOP becoming that? Who knows?
Well, I think there's a case to say that that might be a role that they might look at very seriously. I think we're also in a kind of slightly Mad Max-like post-apocalyptic wasteland. After all of the changes that were run through during the late 2000s and early 2010 onwards, we had a huge amount of upheaval with GCSE specs being replaced every 2-3 years, and there was no sense of resources becoming bedded in, if you like. Textbooks were torn up and thrown away within 2 years and all this sort of thing, and it was really a grim time, because a lot of careful built-up resources like the diagnostic questions and things like that probably just went. And as you know, as a teacher, you know, when you get a worksheet and the worksheet has 8 questions that are from your spec and 2 that aren't, that worksheet, you know, either you go and re-edit it and rebuild it, or you just sit there and go, actually, I'll find another one that's more fit for purpose, because you're busy and you're under time pressure. So yeah, it does need someone to come out and to put together a good range of these problems, because, you know, for me, the longer I go on, the more I think that kids start to understand physics by having their understanding challenged through working through problems, working through questions, and producing decent explanations for these. That's what teaches them physics, and the more we can do about that, the better.
Yes, they could use Ben Rogers' refutation text, Robin. It came to me. Refutation text, where you say, some people think that dropping 2 stones, one heavy, one light, will hit the ground at different times, but I really like those, and I do use those still. So what was the main bit of the podcast going to be? Well, you put out a clarion call and the tragic death of Tim Hardingham a few weeks ago, saying everyone should be more Tim. And I can't remember if I said this in the podcast last week, but our sixth form have gone into a circuit breaker, whatever we call it. They've all been sent home because a quarter of them were going to be self-isolating because there were 3 or 4 cases. And I thought, oh, I need to be more Tim here. What would Tim do? I want them to do practical work. I want them to experience practical work. What would Tim do? And Tim was famous for his spreadsheets, wasn't he? And he had one, he had the, until I found the FET photoelectric effect, I used the Tim spreadsheet photoelectric effect, which I've since lost. It must be somewhere at the school. And he had his famous, which I do when I'm teaching SHM, simple harmonic motion, the famous modelling simple harmonic motion and getting a perfect sine graph, which I entirely got from Tim, which is beautiful. I thought, I'm about to do resistivity. We were just about to do the practical. I needed to teach them to use a micrometer. I'm going to be more Tim, I thought. And so I made a simulation of the resistivity of a wire experiment. This was complicated, Robin, by the fact that we now use Teams, so I'm not allowed any macros. All my geeky coding can't work. It has to work in flat, bog-standard Excel. And so I found a willing guinea pig, mid to low ability, this morning, and asked them to try the experiment. And what do you think of it, Robin?
Well, thank you, Thomas, for that, for bigging me up there like that. Yes, mid to low ability. God, I think I've been promoted. I thought it was very good. It's really interesting. If you can visualize it, a kind of data table that's been laid out there that is completely blank, and then at the top you have a kind of simulation of the wire, and you can move a little carré, is that what they're called? Yeah. A little carré along each section of the wire to get a resistivity reading from the wire all the way along. So it's a nice sort of way of mimicking the experiment and mimicking the practical techniques that the students have to do. It's not just a video that they sit there and watch, it's a thing that they actually have to interact with, and so it gets as close as possible to being a practical while still being on a spreadsheet. And even mid to low ability students manage to work it out and use it. So yeah, thank you.
So yeah, what I did was I put I have in my stock photos of it, I've taken over the years, 3 photos of a micrometer, so you can do the diameter, and I had was a carré that you put in a cell, and I'd locked the spreadsheet down, and listener, if you, I will obviously link to it in the show notes, the password for the spreadsheet is physics lowercase, very very simple. when you place the carry down next to the wire, which is the crocodile clip, you don't get the same reading every time. I put in some uncertainty, which I enjoyed. So whenever you put it down, it's like it's up to 3% uncertainty. But if you do unlock it and you look at the hidden sheets, you can find you can change the uncertainty and you can change the metal they're testing and all that stuff, and you can change the instructions. But it actually worked really well. They got a good experience. They all did it, which is good. I got 17 in my lower sixth. They all did it. They all got something from it. I think they enjoyed it. The main thing was the instructions weren't great, but that's an iterative thing. So I'd given them a whole blank sheet to put their results in, and some of them tried to type their entire results in the bottom row of the table, which had five columns in it. But I just thought, wow, what else could I simulate? I had never thought of doing simulations like that in Excel. Now, I am a geek, but it wasn't super difficult what I did in that. What other experiments could I do and be more Tim? So I'm going to put Robin on the spot now and see what he thinks.
So one that strikes me straight away, because it's been on my mind as being a bit of a worry for my year 13s, is the penetration of gamma radiation through lead. So they have to do a thing where they find the half thickness, effectively, and that's an A-level core practicum. So that's one I think definitely straight away you could say they could do. There's a similar experiment on our GCSE spec. The students have to find a way of working out which material absorbs gamma radiation most, and they have to measure 1 centimetre thicknesses of different materials and so forth and so forth. So I think that might actually work quite well in a Excel spreadsheet, and because it's one that if they are locked down and they're at home and or things like this, they can actually access via a spreadsheet. So that would be one. And also it's quite an abstract experiment to start with, because you don't actually see a great deal happening. You just see a sort of source being put there, different materials being put in the way, and a counter reading changing. So I think that's something that might fit that bill. Ohm's law, of course, in some ways, and we've talked about the FET simulation in the past, in some ways electricity benefits from a simulation to support it, because you don't get the bulbs broken. There's a resistor that's hanging on by a thread, and so the resistance doesn't what it reads, and there's a dodgy lead in there and all this sort of thing. The battery's going flat. You don't get all those things interfering with it. They get a nice clean result from it. So that's another one I think might work.
Yeah, both the radiation ones, I'm just thinking already, you could have a lot of fun. I use conditional formatting a lot. I don't know if you know that. So you could have type in the metal you want, give them a list, and it would change the colour of a cell accordingly. So, and you could say how many bits of metal do you want between the detector, and you could have cells coloured in. It takes a bit of work. But once you've got it, my challenge is always remembering I've done it. I mean, in my time out of teaching, you know, I left teaching for 9 years and was a management consultant. I did a fair bit of work with document management systems, and sometimes I think what we need is, going back to what we were saying earlier, we need a document management system for all physics teachers with all the resources. And that's kind of what the resources website I set up, resources.physicsteachingpodcast.com, is. So I was hoping people would register and start starring and marking and grading and reviewing the resources on there. I mean, I do put my resources in there as I find them, and I will put this spreadsheet in there as well.
But it's a time game. It's a time and priority game. And I'm sure, you know, most teachers have recognised this. It's like this week, you know, I've it's been year 11 mock week this week. So I've had X number of papers to grade, and they're pretty hefty papers. So that's been top of my list, and everything else kind of falls off the bottom. So, you know, when you've got things like, you know, your lesson planning is being squeezed because you're having to do marking or writing reports or whatever it is you have to do that week, you're going to find that things like doing work on a separate database for the benefit of the wider community kind of falls off the bottom. And I completely understand that, and I get that, and I've been there, and I do get it. And that's why we do need that help from outside. We need somebody, you know, we have lots and lots of people telling us what we should do in education and how we should be and these sorts of things. And I think sometimes maybe we should put back and say, well, what you could really do to help us to do that is provide the resources to have a collated library of educational resources, worksheets, diagnostic questions, simulated practicals, videos, all these sorts of things, so that we can draw on those, and that they're in one place, and that they're well catalogued, and that there's a good search engine on them, and that somebody's thought about how to put it together, and that we can use.
There you go. There's a challenge to the IOP. We need you, IOP. We need you. Spend some money. You spent a lot of money getting us to change the way we teach energy, and I think we've tried very hard at that. Now do something back for us.
I think I've just lost my fellowship. That's it. I'm out now.
No, I don't think you'll be stripped of your fellowship. I think that's a really serious and useful thing they could do. And if I've learned, I mean, you know, I didn't have much interaction with the IOP in my but until we had the podcast, to be honest, I didn't find much that they'd done in my early part of my career was super helpful, so I kind of put them to one side. But I think from what I've seen, they do want to help, and maybe that is something they could do. Set aside some money regularly for 20 years to provide resources for teachers.
Well, to be fair, and in their defence, they have. So the IOP, I think, did realise that, you know, in many ways, there's a lot of people out there doing great work promoting physics, not just in education, but across the whole piece. And so they've recently released, as part of their new strategy, a challenge fund where you can bid for up from 100,000. 100,000 was the minimum grant. Northwards of that, and they've got £10 million that they're giving away in donations for people who promote physics to the wider community. So this is something that the IOP kind of know is important. They know that promoting physics is important. This is something that somebody can make a case for. Who knows? Maybe I'll do it. I don't know. But it would be something. So if you this is something you've often thought, oh, wow, I'd really love to go and make physics resources for a living, get in touch with the IOP. Talk to them about their challenge fund. Maybe it's something that you could do.
We do need a platinum-coated recording studio, don't we?
Yeah, I'm sure they would be more than willing to read our bid on that.
I can't see any problem with a platinum-coated recording studio for the podcast. Oh, dear. So, Axel, I cannot imagine there aren't many listener who... I cannot imagine that the listener has not made the odd spreadsheet. Maybe we can start sticking your spreadsheets, if you've done them, up on the resources website, and we can rate and review them and use the resources website for what I was hoping it would be used for. I will certainly put mine up. I'll put it in the show notes, and I should think by the time this goes live on Thursday, I would have made Robin's radiation ones, because that sounds like fun. And that being part-time, I am time rich, and I like being geeky and fiddling around with things, so maybe I'll knock that out for Robin.
And I can say you are the only time-rich physics teacher in the country. So, you know, that's it. And even though you'll be amazed at how quickly your time gets eaten up by these things, and it is one of those things. So, you know, the IOP do fantastic work, and there's a huge amount of really, really good stuff on IOP Spark. But just literally getting that stuff there takes a massive amount of effort and checking and collation and all this thing. And because it is the IOP, they have to be absolutely certain that it is just so. And I think that's one of the reasons they introduced the Challenge Fund, actually, is because it basically gets them away from this idea that everything has to be absolutely perfect physics, because they are, if you like, the subject authority. So what they're doing is farming this out to people who perhaps can take a bit more of a risk. The IOP's reputation is really, really important, and it's important to all of us because it is our learned society. And so then protecting their reputation is an important thing, and it's a very important thing that they do. So they're saying to other people, well, hey, you know, we might not be able to do these things because we have to be really, really, really careful and take very, very, very high editorial standards. But you might be able to do other things that we can support. And that's throwing it open to the community. So that's a good thing.
Yeah, I think, given we've recorded this very professionally in one take, all the time saved in editing, Robin, will be put into your spreadsheet. Lucky you.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah, one take.
One take. Right, well, it's getting dark here now. It's actually it's a reasonable walk. We have marched many kilometres across the countryside today, and we are going to march back. So I'll just take this time to say, Robin, thank you very much.
Yeah, which way is it back, by the way? Is it that way or that way? Oh, dear. Thank you very much. I'll see you next week.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to the Physics Teaching Podcast Outside once again. The podcast is presented by me, Thomas W.P., and Robin Griffiths. And the podcast is produced and edited by me, Thomas W.P., with Robin doing the show notes. Thanks for listening, and we'll speak to you next week. And don't forget to give us your top tips for introducing and teaching magnetism and magnetic fields.